Okay, so once again, just want to introduce people to our main guest speaker, Dr. Raymond Peet. Are you there, Dr. Peet?
Yes.
Okay, thanks so much for joining us again. As always, and as hopefully the new listeners to the show, I know there's lots of other people who listen to the shows repeatedly and or who listen to the podcast, but for those people who perhaps have never heard your voice or read any of your work, would you just outline your academic and professional background for those people so that they can get a good sense of who you are?
I got a master's degree in general studies with work in literature and philosophy and other things from the University of Oregon. Then about 8 years later, I went back to specialize in biology, especially physiology of aging and reproduction, for a PhD in 1972.
Okay. All right, well, let's start the show then. So in your recent newsletter, which was entitled Comments on Cancer Therapy, you coined the phrase, I think I've not heard it before, but you coined the phrase trust-annoia in response to your definition of paranoia, that being the belief that powerful forces are trying to harm you. In the former, trust-annoia is the irrational belief that those in power are working for your benefit. So in trust-annoia, then, a carefully sculpted directive and narrative has been foisted on us in the form of powerful entities, often protected from prosecution, as in the case of vaccine makers, for example, who tell us they have the answer and only they can help us, so just like the governments generally do, with the usual results being inefficiency and waste. But the medical industry, and particularly their failed war on cancer, along with all the other wars, has yielded few results at the cost of countless suffering and death. And you outlined a chronology culminating in the infamous Carnegie and Rockefeller foundations, which a lot of the people listening, perhaps the alternative populations, have certainly heard about, especially with the Rockefellers and their central banking. So this was at the beginning of the 20th century, then. This was pivotal in the establishment of these powerful institutions of the false religion of the mechanistic biology, as opposed to holistic and relevant research, which you constantly bring out, which has only just emerged in publications and theories from eminent scientists, of whom you've previously mentioned, from Gilbert Ling to Gerald Pollack and the others, and the other scientists like Mei-Wan Ho and the others that Brad and Jeremy have been busy interviewing in their coming expose on the back of a tiger, which we're all waiting for. Can you discuss the shift in perception that's occurring away from a dogma which has been upheld for so long?
First, I want to mention that the word trust-annoia was, I think, coined by Laura Nader,
okay,
anthropologist. But the shift of perception, I think it's only partial. In biology, there's a lot of good science that's picking up or continuing from the ideas that were suppressed around the Second World War, when those institutions, including the medical establishment, which fused itself with state power and the foundations, the science that was being developed by the government for warfare was shifted over to take advantage of these mechanistic ideas that medicine had developed. So the government and the medical establishment really began powerfully working together right after the Second World War, with a lot of money flowing from the government to medical research, which was sometimes you couldn't distinguish it from biological warfare research. Some of the same people went right from one field to the other. For example, Carlton Gajdusek, who got the Nobel Prize for slow virus research, he was working in biological warfare. And I've outlined some of my suspicions about how he came to invent that idea of the slow virus. I suspect it was a cover-up for the effects of radiation on the brain and other organisms rather than this hypothetical virus that Gay-Lussac invented. But the dogma has essentially denied all of the traditional ideas of biology and the nature of life to impose the idea that things are predefined from Gregor Mendel in the 19th century. The idea of the gene was gradually used to deny that plant breeders and animal breeders were really changing the plants. If they seemed to be producing big animals from little animals or big plums from little plums, the most radical changes they were producing, rather than being adaptive to the environment, the textbooks at the time I was in graduate school said, well, these were genes that really existed previously. Now, we've just for the first time in science, we have simply revealed that there were genes for these traits, which the plant and animal developers seem to be producing. So it seems that there were these secret genes that explained everything. It really was sort of a magic act or metaphysics. They made up the story as they went along to explain things that really could more easily be explained by the idea that the organism is highly adaptive. And the gene idea allowed people to work, create changes in the DNA so that they could now produce engineered organisms. After 100 years of denying that there really was any adaptation, they said, and now that we're in control of the genes, we'll make organisms the way we want them. But they were claiming that it was purely in the genes and that they could control it, so there was no danger of things being unpredictable or going wrong.
Hmm.
And people like Barbara McClintock, who in the 1940s and 50s, she was demonstrating that organisms can change their own genes to adapt to situations. So the idea of being determined by their genes was exactly turned on its head by her and other people, who showed that the organisms change their own genes an organized way.
So what do you think is going to happen with genetically modified organisms? Do you think they're going to start changing the genes that have been put in them?
When you realize how ignorant the molecular biologists and molecular geneticists have been, you have to worry that things could be much, much worse than anyone so far has suspected. James Watson, of Watson and Crick, who invented the structure to explain the double helix of DNA, he's now 88 years old, and just a couple of weeks ago, he was quoted in the New York Times as saying if he was starting over to understand cancer, he would not study molecular biology, he would study biochemistry. He said he never thought he would have to learn the Krebs cycle. He said, now, just a couple months ago, I had decided it would be necessary. But the arrogance of these geneticists meant that they simply didn't have to know anything at all right. about biology.
Purely reductionist thinking.
Yeah.
Huh. So getting onto the kind of change in perception, I think you made an interesting point when I read your newsletter that science essentially was becoming a private matter, and that was in reference to the procuring of difficult substances to get, like radioactive isotopes for doing research. Now, governments in this situation would be entirely responsible for distributing radioactive substances to companies, obviously would be under their control. They would largely be able to, I would think, predict the outcomes which they wanted to find in terms of having complete control over this material. It's not like you can just get radioactive isotopes from anywhere and do your own research and find information contrary to what it is they might want to tell you about the supposed safety, perhaps, of some of these things. But that was pretty interesting. And then the talking about the application of various medical approaches being very closely controlled by a fairly fairly large overseeing industry, which we'll have mentioned the medicine industry as being exactly that, an extremely lucrative, profitable, and to be very much protected from any assaults. And this is where you also made reference to in the early stages of the formation of doctors and the industry, the doctors themselves wanted government to protect them from other practitioners. And you mentioned the heroic I thought it was very funny, but it's very true. The heroic medicine that was practiced by these early doctors included using mercury, bleeding, vomiting, diuresis, enuresis, and all sorts of purgative mechanisms by which some, if not quite a large proportion of patients died, and then, of course, turned to alternatives because the doctors were being so blatant about what they're doing and overtly killing people that the local folk medicine or midwives or other people that had various skills in different areas and were definitely used before that. This was then being seen as the alternative that they had to pursue because otherwise this heroic medicine was just going to kill more people than not. So
recently, anthropologists were able to identify the places where the Lewis and Clark expedition had camped by finding so much mercury in soil.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay. All right. So just in terms of the protectionist, I mean, you would almost call it a racket. I mean, I'm sure it is a racket. I think that's probably the best term for it, actually. This protectionist approach to medicine and how a lot of the research is very hard to either replicate because the products that they're being used are issued under very tightly controlled circumstances, or whether in fact the results of some of these outcomes are really not laid out accurately, and that's why we find postdoc or PhD research being done to show the opposite is true for a lot of the things that we're being told by the quote-unquote authority on medicine, that this is the way it is, and that, for example, as we've mentioned many times, and you've brought this out in the very early days, that you know, sugar is essential for you. It's not bad for you. The same goes for salt. The same goes for saturated fat. And all these lies that they would have us believe when actually there is evidence which is done by very credible scientists and PhD researchers. So the fact that the authority out there is a quote-unquote authority doesn't mean to say that you have to believe it. And this, I found it very funny. I'd never heard the trust annoyer quote before, so that made me chuckle quite a bit, because the opposite generally in questioning society is paranoia, that they're doing something that's not good for us. I know here, especially on the west coast of California, we look up at the skies and we look at the chemtrails and we see them spreading out and we're just like, that is not normal. We read about and hear about fluoride in the water and we're very skeptical and wanting that pulled out of the water. There's no reason for it at all to be in there, and the research shows that it's very damaging. There's many other instances where the supposed authority and the government that most people definitely shouldn't look at as being the final say in anything, has total control over this. So it's always very good to be skeptical and not just accept what they're saying as a truth, but really do your own research. And that's why we love having you on the show, Dr. Pete, because you've done a lot of this research and you brought out so many things that have illuminated a lot of seemingly obvious facts to people when they read the research. So you go ahead.
There's one group that I've read many of their papers that were published over a period of about 50 years. And back in the 50s and 60s, Otto Warburg had completely ignored the gene mutation theory of cancer and was showing that it was definable and understandable in terms of a simple metabolic imbalance. And starting in the 1960s, the Pentagon started financing people who worked on projects to debunk and disprove, supposedly, or at least defame Otto Warburg. Yeah. And one of these groups is still publishing, right? As recently as last year, I read some papers saying that Otto Warburg was wrong because we, et cetera, and their reasoning isn't right. They're misinterpreting what Warburg said, but it's so important that the Pentagon has consistently financed people to push a doctrine such as disproving supposedly ideas that would have invalidated the whole war on cancer.
Right.
And as if our tax dollars should be supporting the Pentagon to do such work.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't it the FBI that I heard this the other week, and I'm like, that sounds like actually pretty plausible. I remember watching a Mel Gibson movie a long time ago, Conspiracy Theorist, it was called. Now, and I heard also that the FBI were the organization that coined the term conspiracy theorist just to give people the one word phrase that would debunk any person who was coming out with some fairly very controversial and surprising news about something that was supposedly accepted as fact, and that it was just regularly used as a kind of method of invalidating anybody who had any sense of a truth that was looking in the opposite direction. So the word conspiracy theorist on its own right was coined by a kind of government agents to turn this on its head.
And, when they have hundreds of billions of dollars to spend on their conspiracy, it becomes so pervasive, you can hardly say it's a conspiracy. It's an alternate reality that they're constructing.
Yeah. All right. Well, you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Garberville, 91.1 FM. Also on the web at kmud.org. Yeah, if you're in the area, there's a 923 number, 923-3911. If you're outside the area, it's 1-800-KMUD-RAD, which is 1-800-568-3723. From 7:30 till the end of the show, callers are very welcome to call in with any questions about this month's subject of exploring the alternatives. We're very pleased to have Dr. Raymond Pete with 40 years or thereabouts of postdoc research coming our way with lots of facts and figures about the relevance of what we read and hear and we think is true, but he actually has a very different viewpoint in which to see that. And Dr. Pete, I time and time again, even though I've spoken to you quite a lot and we have had you on the radio show a lot, I still have to remind myself that your perspective is very much a biology-based perspective. And I think to remember what you said earlier in the radio show, I think that's a point that a lot of people forget, is that biology has really been superseded, hasn't it, and squashed, if you like, by the tax dollar corporate model of genetics and the war on cancer?
The medical establishment has had its own reasons for following their theory of cancer, but it has been reinforced by the government's biological warfare perspective. So they blended them together to say that everything is determined by the DNA, and you don't have to learn anything about biology or about the chemistry of life itself.
Let me get you to hold that thought a moment, because I think we have one or two callers who have already been calling in. So let's see if we can take this first call. Caller, where are you from, and what's your question?
Ask the doctor if he could talk about any alternatives for emphysema, you know, as opposed, you know, something other than the pills that they give and the respirators that they give.
Yeah.
And I will take my answer on the air.
Okay. Dr. Pete, did you hear that? Because I didn't catch the first part, but emphysema.
For I've had a couple of very interesting experiences with people who had apparent emphysema. That was the diagnosis. Extremely inefficient lungs. One person was purple in the face, and his memory was affected. He was getting so little oxygen to his brain. The other person was a woman in her 30s who had been that way for about 15 years. And in the woman's case, it started when she had multiple estrogen injections when she was about 20. And that got me reading about the history of experimental emphysema. And they found that they could produce it, reduce the ability of the lungs to absorb oxygen by 90% in just an hour after an injection of an excess amount of estrogen. And in the case of the man, I suspected that it was a combination of too much unsaturated fat in his diet, increasing his estrogen actions and decreasing his thyroid function. So I gave him some progesterone and pregnenolone and I think a little thyroid. And in 2 weeks, the next time I saw him, that was in Toluca, altitude well over 8,000 feet. And his office was upstairs in a building without an elevator. And 2 weeks after he was sitting, puffing, and purple, and he took me around the city, took me up to his office, and just zooming up the ramps, 82 or 3 years old at that time, and fully functional lungs as quickly as 2 weeks.
Wow.
The young woman tried different things, but she noticed that she felt better when a doctor prescribed Armour thyroid, and she kept talking him into giving her bigger doses, got him up to 5 grains, and she was feeling pretty recovered. But she went to another doctor and got another 5 grains from him, and with the third doctor each prescribing 5 grains as what they considered a maximum dose, she recovered completely over a period of 2 or 3 months.
Wow.
With 15 grains of thyroid a day.
Yeah, but if you don't activate the thyroxine in Armour thyroid, which is 3/4 of the active material, you're only getting a 1/4 of it. So, in effect, she was only getting about 4 grains of activity.
Right.
So you're looking at emphysema in this, in both of these cases, then, as really as an energy depletion and or factors that are contributing to inflammation and calcium influx being pushed back by thyroid hormone?
There were animal studies 20, 30, 40 years ago in which progesterone resolved their emphysema. Pregnenolone and progesterone both allow cells to handle water properly so that they don't swell up and so that they retain normal elasticity.
Right, got it. We do have another caller on here, so let's take this next caller and see where we're going. Caller, you're on the air. What's your question?
Hi, I had a question. What do you think of using the anti-adrenaline drug clonidine to reduce adrenaline at night I've read of some people's experience with using 100 microgram dose, and it's working quite well. So, yeah,
we'll start with
that. Yeah, what was the name of that?
Quanidine.
Guanidine.
Quanidine.
GU.
Clonidine.
Oh, clonidine.
An adrenaline drug.
Clonidine, maybe. CLNO. CLON.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, that's a blood pressure lowering drug, too.
Sometimes, yeah, a low thyroid person sometimes compensates by producing gigantic amounts of adrenaline just to keep running. It helps to maintain their body temperature at normal and keeps their heart rate up, and they can seem even hyperthyroid sometimes when they have very little T3 production or very high reverse T3 blocking it. And when these people have their daily adrenaline measured in their urine, some of them are making 30 or 40 times more than the normal amount just to compensate for hypothyroidism. And those people, they often feel a great reduction of anxiety and tension, pressure, and so on. But since the adrenaline is compensating in many ways, keeping their blood sugar up, it's important to be very cautious when you oppose the adrenaline, because it can sometimes give you asthma or low blood sugar.
Because of it swings the other way. You're talking about it kind of crashes. Yeah.
Do you think that do you think it could be used safely at a dose such as 100 micrograms? Does that sound like a reasonable dose? Do you know?
I've never experimented with it myself. I don't know what the right dose would be.
Okay. I've also read that it actually lowers cortisol as well. So do you think that would be in a direct fashion or indirectly as perhaps a result of it lowering the adrenaline? The adrenaline in chronic excess is also highly stressful in the organism. It can definitely keep the cortisol high.
The cortisol generally follows a period of excess adrenaline. So if you take your adrenaline down, it might let you lower your cortisol unless you lower your glucose too much, and that can increase your cortisol.
Yeah, salt and sugar are great ways to lower adrenaline. I recommend that to people who are performing and they get anxious before they perform. Tell them, stir in a little salt and a glass of orange juice. It works great.
Okay, well, thanks for your call.
Okay,
Gordon.
Thank you.
Okay, so it's 7:30 here. You're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor, KMED, Garberville, 91.1 FM. The call-in number for this area here is 923-3911. Or if you live outside the area or you're on the web, 1-800-KMUD-RAD, which is 1-800-568-3723 for your calls. And Dr. Ray Pete is our guest. Okay, so Dr. Pete, I guess moving on, I wanted to ask you a little bit about epigenetics then. So you've mentioned the study of epigenetics, which is currently getting quite a lot of attention, as providing clues to many different pathologies stemming from environmental origins or ingested pollution, both atmospheric and dietary. Now, we fully understand the world we live in now is as far more toxic than the world the Native American Indians, for example, lived in, with cancers and diabetes almost unknown then, but which now are commonplace. It's important now than ever to make sure you're eating organically raised food, drinking organic milk and juices. You mentioned orange juice a lot, as well as clean filtered water. And the same goes for the water you bathe in, with added fluoride causing known cancers. From a holistic perspective, there exists a very real mind-body connection between your thoughts and your health that we've mentioned in previous shows. And the convincing benefits of meditation or stilling the mind being healing. What do you see as the mechanisms by which this acts in terms of meditation? Because I know you have a biological perspective And you're telling me there's another caller there, eh? Oh, okay. Let's hold that thought for a second, if you can retain what I've asked you. But let's take this next caller. Caller, you're on the air. Where are you from?
Yeah, I'm from the Laytonville area.
Okay, what's your question?
I was wondering, I read an article recently, and it said it was about the duality of taste buds.
Of taste buds?
Yeah, okay. It was written by, I think you pronounce it rhinosinusitis.
Rhinosinusitis. Rhinosinusitis?
Yeah, that might be it.
Yeah.
It's people who, like, are constantly sick and have, like, a cold or flu-like symptom.
Got it. You have a running nose and...
Yeah, and they were claiming that the bitter taste buds are the body's first line of defense, and the cilia acts as like a filter for bacteria, and then in the nose it releases a nitric oxide and does all this great stuff and, you know, tells the body that something that could hurt it's entering the system.
Okay.
And I was wondering if you guys thought that maybe, like, smoking or being in a, you know, like the fires we've had recently could coat these cilia or the taste buds and give you the symptoms kind of like
sinusitis. Okay. Well, I've got my thoughts. But, Dr. Pete, what's your thought on whether or not the atmospheric pollution from forest fires that the callers mentioned might contribute to this situation, rhinosinusitis.
And also smoking, too.
And smoking, yeah.
Yeah, all of these things are not only contacting the membranes locally in your nose and mouth, but when you breathe them, you swallow them because they dissolve in the saliva. And in the last few years, people have been observing the same sort of taste buds existing in the intestine so that your intestine can detect the chemistry of what's present, even though you aren't consciously maybe tasting it, but the nerves are still doing their chemical analysis. And so the one of the things that andrologists have been noticing for 100 years is that the inflammation of the nose and throat very often starts in the intestine. If you have a chemical irritant or a stretching from gas or constipation or a viral or bacterial infection, there can be no toxin or germ present in your nose, but the nose will get inflamed and start running, and then later, after the inflammation is underway, then it can pick up germs. But there's a very close integration between the respiratory system and the intestine. So things that you've eaten will affect the rhinitis, and that's something that people often neglect. They'll take vitamin pills thinking that it'll help their immunity or their allergies. But I've seen dozens of people who recovered from their chronic runny nose when they stopped taking their vitamin and mineral supplements.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you would recommend to take? Or food to eat?
Avoiding irritating foods, green salads, uncooked vegetables, and many seeds and nuts are always irritating, and some people can have a runny nose from just having a salad once a week. It sets up a chronic irritation in their intestine.
All right. Thank you very much. That was very, very informative. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Don't forget that people listening, you can always listen to this podcast on the web at www.kmud.org. Go to the audio archives and just select Friday Night Live, and it's the third Friday of every month. Okay, I think we have two or three callers, so let's get going with these next caller. Next caller, where are you from, and what's your question?
Hi, I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area.
Okay, hey, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Dr. Pete, I was on a low-carb diet for 2 years and ate a lot of artificial sweetener during that time, I have two questions. The first one is, what negative effects have artificial sweeteners had on my body? And the second one is, how can I undo, or is it even possible to undo those negative effects?
The artificial sweeteners sometimes activate insulin and cause weight gain just by acting on your hormones, even without increasing your food intake. But they have different toxicities. Some of them are excitotoxins if you eat large quantities of them. But usually, if you just stop using them and eat a proper, non-irritating diet, things will correct themselves just nutritionally.
Oh, wow. That's great. Thank you very much.
You had a second question?
He answered it.
Okay.
So
all right. I thought it was too. Okay, fine.
Thank you for your call.
Well, thanks for your call. Okay. We have one other caller on there. So let's take this next caller. Caller, where are you from? And what's your question?
I'm from Yucaipa, Southern California.
Okay. What's your question?
I wanted to find out if Dr. Pete knows anything about alternatives for seizure medication.
Okay, I'm sure. In fact, I know. Dr. Pete, seizure medication, or in fact, your rational approach to treating epilepsy or other seizures?
Since we were just talking about the intestine, that's something that should always be taken into account. Make sure that you're not disturbing your system by eating green smoothies or too many nuts and raw foods and such, because irritation in the digestive system will increase the things that promote seizures or lower the threshold for them. And the brain is one of our biggest steroid-forming organs, produces considerable amounts of DHEA, progesterone, pregnenolone, and metabolites of those. And those have a quieting effect. And when the brain is under stress, those increase to compensate for the excitatory effects. There are some foods that specifically excite and damage the nerves and tend to predispose you to seizures. Amino acids, for example, including glutamic acid, aspartic acid, cysteine, and tryptophan are the worst amino acids for lowering the threshold. Supplements of progesterone have been used to reduce the sensitivity to various factors. The threshold to excitation and seizure increases in proportion to the amount of pregnenolone, progesterone, and several of the metabolites of these.
Yeah, okay, I had a client that had epilepsy, and she was able to wean herself off all of her medication and resume driving and lives a very normal life now. And she sticks to a very strict diet that doesn't have any kind of food that the bacteria can live on in her intestine. She takes pregnenolone and progesterone, and she has a thyroid prescription. And she also takes anti-adrenaline herbs like valerian and skullcap and passion flower.
And she had grand mal seizures, didn't she?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
My daughter, she's 35. She's had them since she was 5.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried the Progest-E. She was taking about 1 to 2 bottles every 3 days, but she was able to reduce her medication by 75%. But she just couldn't keep that up because, you know, you can't keep taking that much.
Dr. Pete, what do you think about the dose of progesterone the callers talked about?
Well, the lady that I worked with, she was taking 1/8 of a teaspoon of Progest-E 3 times a day.
Has she had her thyroid hormones, including reverse T3, measured?
No.
Those can, when someone is resistant to progesterone and needs extremely large amounts of it to feel right, it's usually because their liver is letting estrogen and the excitatory things accumulate, and it, so it takes a supernormal amount of progesterone to steady things. And if you eat the things that your liver needs, not too much of some proteins which contain the excitatory cysteine and so on, but for example, gelatin or glycine as an additive, shifting the balance away from the excitatory proteins towards more sugar, orange juice, for example, and making sure that your thyroid is letting your liver use the proteins efficiently to store sugar and eliminate the excitatory estrogen and other things.
Yeah, I think
I had another question.
Go ahead, yeah.
My hands, within the last 6 months, my hands have started to shake, and whenever I write with a pen, I have jerk moments, you know, jerky movements, mm-hmm. and I'm not smooth anymore. When I just relax my hand, it doesn't shake. But
how quickly or slowly did it come on?
It's gradual.
Over what period of time?
6 months ago.
Oh, 6 months ago. Okay, and so Dr. P, in terms of handwriting, changes in handwriting, is it let me ask you first this. Do you have a fine tremor or a coarse tremor? Do you notice if you put your hands out in front of you, whether you visibly see any shaking or your hands by your side?
Yeah, it's a very fine tremor.
Very fine, so okay. And had you noticed this tremor before you noticed your handwriting change, or was your handwriting the clue?
I was holding a book in my hand, and I noticed it that way.
Yeah, okay. Dr. P, in terms of excitation or muscular excitation, contraction, and tremors, what do you think about when you think about that physiologically?
Vitamins and minerals are the first things I think of. I've known people who had what they thought was Parkinson's disease, and all they needed was... In one case, vitamin B12 did it immediately. Other people, magnesium supplements have a sudden steadying effect, anti-tremor. Sometimes more calcium and vitamin D will do it.
All of these are antagonizing the excitotoxicity and that effect.
Yeah.
They're net anti-inflammatories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And pregnenolone is... always protective whenever you're under stress. You tend to use your steadying, quieting steroids faster.
Right.
And sometimes just a supplement of pregnenolone can quiet things.
The caller, did you take most of that down?
Yeah, I'm going to actually listen to the broadcast afterwards, but
yeah,
I have one other question. Okay. Alpha lipoic acid, my daughter wanted me to ask about that.
Right. What? Dr. P, what do you think of the sulfur containing lipoic acid?
I think it's one of the safer things, experimentally at least.
Okay.
There are some...
You know what it does?
In small amounts, I think it's safe to experiment with it.
And what would it be used for, though?
It is supposed to keep your glucose metabolism efficient. Biotin and lipoic acid and coenzyme Q10 and the various B vitamins work together.
I'm sure there's some component of energy production in it too, because I noticed that in fitness and bodybuilding, that seems to be one of the many components that they advocate for, a supplement stack, if you want to call it that.
I have one other question, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind at all, but we do have two more callers after you, so go ahead.
Real quick, yeah. Dr. Pete, you said that when you have higher T3, it can lower T4.
If you're under stress, reverse T3 goes up under the influence of cortisol. And if you lower cortisol, your reverse T3 just naturally goes down. Everything that helps to lower cortisol will help to free up the normal T3 production without reverse T3. And things that can help include sugar and aspirin and B vitamins and minerals.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for your calls. Okay, so we have two more callers. So let's take this next caller. Caller, where are you from and what's your question?
I'm from Eureka, and my question is, can cannabis assist with epilepsy, or do you know anyone who has used cannabis with epilepsy, and what's your overall view on cannabis?
Well, I would automatically be a little bit skeptical about cannabis for epilepsy due to its estrogenic compounds, but I'll let Dr. Pete comment more on that.
Some people think it soothes the symptoms, but again, I think it's good to be cautious, especially if it's used in any crude form that might have other plant components in it that could be irritating.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for your call. We've got two more here still, so let's take the next caller. Caller, your question and where are you from?
My name is Robert. I'm from Trinidad. And I'm interested, I like stevia a lot, as it's the only sweetener I'm using right now. And I heard a little bit about maybe that too, just like some of the other more artificial sweeteners. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if it has the same issue.
Dr. P, what do you think of stevia as opposed to some of the other artificial sweeteners in terms of its safety or its allergenicity?
I've never heard of serious allergic reactions to it. Seems to be fairly harmless.
And caller, what was the main reason that you were using a sweetener like stevia rather than sugar?
I had stevia, and so I'm not wanting to eat it. Maybe you think stevia is an issue with candida.
Oh, she said she has candida.
Candida thrives when you're lacking some of the membrane surface antibodies, IgA, and those depend on many things, but especially thyroid and progesterone. So if you're low thyroid, you will both have a problem regulating your blood glucose, and your immune system will tend to favor things like candida overgrowth, but other bacteria too can produce similar symptoms. And if you starve candida thoroughly by cutting off all of its sugar supply, it needs glucose, and so it can put out filaments and actually become invasive when you're not feeding it sugar. And if you do have candida in your intestine and you keep it well fed on glucose, it's not going to invade and become deadly. But the worst it does then is to maybe make too much ethyl alcohol. But it can be eradicated pretty easily just with a little, very small amount of flowers of sulfur, just 200 milligrams or so, 2 or 3 days in a row will typically clean up the intestine from candida and other harmful fungus and bacteria.
And that's available at pharmacies over-the-counter, also called sublimed sulfur.
It's called what sulfur?
Either flowers of sulfur, that's easier mm-hmm. to remember, or sublimed mm-hmm. sulfur.
And sometimes precipitated sulfur. It doesn't work if it's ground from crystals.
So you're saying don't do a candida diet, because I'm doing one with some carbs in it, like basically I'm having sweet potatoes. Coconut flour just could not get ketosis, but you're saying don't even bother with that.
Yeah, I think the main rationale for the approach to treating your candida is that if you actually starve yourself of glucose, you're probably going to put yourself at a disadvantage, because you will, by necessity of starving candida from glucose, you'll cause it to invade tissues more thoroughly to seek out sources of carbohydrate or other glucose stores, and actually you really want to just keep a normal diet. Don't avoid and restrict sugar intake, but then if you use something as simple as flours of sulfur, and I think Dr. Pete said 200 milligrams a day for 2 to 3 days, works pretty effectively,
which
for
is
that.
Just like a pinch, a large
yeah.
pinch,
yeah.
And things such as carrot salad, shredded carrots with a little olive oil and vinegar and salt. The oil suppresses candida multiplication, and the carrot has antifungal substances naturally because it grows in the ground and has to avoid being...
It resists digestion.
mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm eating a lot of carrots. I'm eating all of those things. But did you say vinegar too, though?
Well, yeah, and it has to be raw carrot.
Right.
Otherwise, it will be a food source for bacteria.
Okay, we do have another caller, so thanks for your call. Let's take this next caller.
Thank you.
Caller, you're on the air. Where are you from?
Honeydew.
Honeydew. Okay, what's your call, caller? What's your question, sorry?
I'd like to know what is the safe hormone for a person that's transitioning to a trans female.
Hmm. Well, progesterone... is a feminizing. If it's in large amounts, it antagonizes the effects of testosterone. In France, there were studies 40 years ago in which women with whiskers, mustache and sideburns, and chest hair applied progesterone topically, and in 2 or 3 months, I think it was, they feminized their facial hair. And when a man takes just a moderate amount of progesterone orally, it stops the whisker growing or slows it greatly. Those French studies showed that it would reverse the differentiated masculine type bristly hair. And it's safe for men or women, unlike the estrogen that... they use to produce breasts.
There you go. So progesterone.
What would be the dose of progesterone?
It's an individual matter. The quality of your thyroid function and your diet and liver and so on affect your response to it. It's important to make sure that your thyroid is good. A low thyroid person can increase the risk of cancer if they use anything estrogenic.
So what tests should be done?
What tests?
Yeah, to determine the dosage.
If you're wanting to reverse hair growth, you can use it topically. And just watch for the effects.
Uh-huh. And systemically?
Oh, it's safe at several milligrams per day. I've experimented with it and saw that I didn't have to shave for a day if I took around 10 milligrams.
All right. Well, listen, let's keep it there. Let's call that question answered. It is just coming up to 3 minutes to the top of the hour. We're done at 8 o'clock. So thank you, callers, that have listened in. Like I said earlier on, anybody caught part of the show or wants to listen to it again, KMUD has an audio archive that allows you just to go to the website www.kmud.org and then go to audio archives, Friday Night Live, and select the calendar third Friday of the month from the list, and those are the shows recorded from 7 till 8 p.m. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Pete. Let me let people know how to get a hold of you and find out more about you.
Thank you, Dr. Pete. Good night.
Okay, so for those folks who, who've just listened to Dr. Pete for the first time, or those people that follow him closely, I know he's got a pretty big fan club going and a big old Facebook page that he's even completely unaware of. But if people want to go to his website, it's www.raypete.com, R-A-Y-P-E-A-T. There's lots of fully referenced articles available on his website, and he's extremely well-versed in his subject. So I encourage you to take full note of what he says and read what he has. He's not selling anything, and he's not seeking to gain political control or anything like that. So
and, he is aware of his... We have told him about these fan club pages that
he's never looked at it.
He's not associated
he's
with
not
any
at all. He's not at all social media relevant. Anyway, so thanks to those people that have called in tonight. As always, it's a pleasure to receive calls. And I know Dr. Pete gets pretty stimulated by people calling about different subjects, even if it's off topic. So until the third Friday of next month, I wish you good night.
Good night. Thank you for listening.